And today I want to play with that a little bit as we use our football day, the big day, big game, and the metaphors of football, of what happens when we fumble. What happens when the big mistake occurs? What happens when we foul up? And to kind of get us thinking along those lines and to use our football day, we're going to see a few clips. Now, this first one, just count how many fumbles happen in one play. Let's take a look.
Excellent drive to open up this second half. LaMike James fumbled the football, but Miami recovered on the kickoff return. Tannehill in trouble. Tannehill! Oh, he loses the football! Scooped up, still free, bouncing around like a pinball. Washington's got it. And then things went sour.
Yeah, Preston Smith, the rookie out of Mississippi State, the second round pick, pops the ball loose, and then here's your pinball game, Ian. Looked like the Dolphins had a shot at it. Looked like the Redskins had a shot at it.
A loose ball going on there. A lot of loose ball, yikes. And of course, there are a lot of ways fumbles happen and a lot of moments when they take place. Sometimes it doesn't really matter. It's not that big of a deal. Sometimes it's right on the goal line. And this one hurts because this is my team. This is Denver versus Seattle a few years ago. Right on the goal line. Let's take a look.
Get an advantage in the numbers game and the run game as well. But this right here looks like old-fashioned downhill football.
Yeah. Three tight ends and the fullback. Hillman cuts it inside, gets in the end zone, but the ball came out. Did he cross the plane of the goal line? No, he didn't, as the Seahawks have recovered. And there's your guy again, Brandon Browder. Another big play, no flags.
Yes, the longest fumble recovery in NFL history, 109 yards. He went, yeah, painful. Painful one to watch. Now, thankfully, that was a preseason game. Whew. All right. Didn't bode well for the season, though, I'll say. Fumbles so often are those things that other people cause, in football at least. You know, somebody gets a hand in there on the tackle, it nudges it loose, whatever. But there are the occasional fumbles that they're self-inflicted, really. And we couldn't get by checking some fumbles for today without perhaps one of the most infamous self-inflicted fumbles. This one was given a title. Perhaps you know it. It's involved Mark Sanchez of the New York Jets at the time. This is the butt fumble. All right, take a look.
Well, years ago, we talked to Tom Moore, then at Indianapolis, the offensive coordinator. You got a busted play here, and then Sanchez gets hit. The ball is loose, and it's alive.
I have never seen this before in my life. Watch this. Vince Wilfork is going to throw Brandon Moore back into his quarterback. He's going to fumble the football. This is what Reggie White used to do to people, forklift them and just lift them off the ground. Mark Sanchez not expecting it, and it was the backside of Brandon Moore.
Sadly, that may be what Mark Sanchez is remembered for in his football career, a self-inflicted fumble. And still can't explain that one. The commentators there are trying to explain it as if he was surprised by what had happened on the line, that the lineman got pushed into him or something. But if you watch it, it's really just self-inflicted. He runs into his own man and falls down and loses it. It's all his own fault, really. I don't think there's any other way to describe that one. Recognizing fumbles happen, not just in football, but of course in life. Today, in David's story, we come upon his biggest blunder ever. I mean, David's had a pretty successful life up till now. We've been chronicling through it. He started off as the young shepherd boy, the champion against Goliath, the poet, the rock star, if you will, with the harp and lyre, the military champion and commander, and now he's king. I mean, he's reached the top. He's at the pinnacle of success. In fact, he's been king now for probably about 20 years. Everything is going well. Maybe that's part of the problem. We pick up the story. It tells us it's in the spring of the year. the time when kings go out to battle. And David sent Joab, that's one of his generals, with his officers and all Israel with him, and they ravaged the Ammonites and besieged Rabbah. But David remained at Jerusalem. It's a telling line to begin with, isn't it? When kings go out to battle, David sent Joab. Perhaps the first sign of problems ahead. Goes on, it happened then late one afternoon when David rose from his couch and was walking about on the roof of the king's house. He saw from the roof a woman bathing. And here we get the Bible in its very adult form, right? They aren't all kid-friendly stories. Some very adult content going on in the Bible, if you haven't noticed sometimes. He saw the woman bathing, and the woman was very beautiful. Now, you have to understand in the Bible, when the writers give you adjectives, things that describe in a little more detail someone, that it's worth noting. She wasn't just a woman bathing. She was very beautiful. She was a knockout. She was stunning, I suppose. And so David sent someone to inquire about the woman. And it was reported, oh, well, this is Bathsheba, daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite. And so we get two identifiers for this woman. Three, really. We get her name, and then we get this connection. She's the daughter of Eliam, and maybe David knows who that is, if we're going to mention him by name. Maybe he's well known around town. And she's the wife of Uriah the Hittite. He's a foreigner, but he's in David's army. And so we have quickly these identifiers that say, David, she's taken. You might have wanted to find out more about her, but she's married. She's somebody's daughter. Hands off. But David doesn't heed the warning signs. And this is a story, of course, about fumbles. Well, that's a football term. Let's give it the Christian theological term about sin. This is David's season of sin, it seems, here. There's one after another, and it begins, it seems, in part because he's in the wrong place at the wrong time. He's not where he should be. He's not out at battle with his armies. He's not being king as kings would be in those days. He's not leading the charge. Instead, he's lounging. And sin has a way of creeping up on us when we're idle, I think, sometimes. Sin has a way of showing up when we're not sure what to do with ourselves, isn't it? And then there's the warning. The warning's, look, she's married to Uriah. You know him. He's in your army. He's been a faithful commander. But David doesn't heed the warning, and if we're honest and we know our own selves, we sometimes ignore the warning signs too. The red lights flashing, right? They go off in our minds, off in our guts sometimes when we're faced with those moments and those decisions. I think of that robot, right? What was his name? In Lost in Space. Robbie the robot, wasn't it? What would he say?
Warning, Will Robinson. Warning.
Right? He's all over the map. This is a bad situation coming up. Take heed here. David gets the warning from a servant, but he doesn't pay attention. And part of that just seems to be human nature, part of our brokenness, that we have the warning signs before us most of the time. And so often we just don't pay attention. Did you know, sadly, almost every year people die in the Grand Canyon. Sometimes it's heat exposure, but sometimes it's as simple as there's an edge. And there are signs everywhere that say, stay back. Dangerous. You may die. And yet, people test it anyways. No, no, I just want to get a picture a little closer. Ah. The warning signs so often are there, and we don't pay attention to them. I don't pay attention to them, too. Think about your own fumbles in life. When have the warning signs creeped up and you've ignored them? Well, David ignores them full well, and so what does he do? It says, David sent messengers to get her. And she came to him, and he lay with her. And then she returned to her house. And the woman conceived, and she sent and told David, I am pregnant. Now maybe David thought this was going to be simple. He's king. He has power, he has authority, can call anybody to his chambers, and he does. And perhaps he thought this would be a simple moment. But that's the way of sin sometimes. It isn't so well contained. It doesn't stay neat and tidy. And so there's more. There's a consequence. There's a pregnancy. And David's simple, perhaps impulsive moment is gaining speed, enlarging. Sin has consequence and consequences. So David hatches a plan. He sent word to Joab, remember the general out in the battle. Send me. Well, who's he going to send for? Uriah the Hittite, that's right. Send me Uriah. And Joab sent Uriah to David. And when Uriah came to him, David asked, well, how's Joab and the people? How's the war going, Uriah? He's masking it as, he just needs a battle report, right? And then David said to Uriah, hey, Uriah, you've been a really great soldier, faithful. What? Got a little break here, a little R&R. Why don't you go down to your house and wash your feet? It's an interesting phrase. I think we might know what that means. And so Uriah went out of the king's house, and there followed him a present from the king. David sends along maybe some wine and cheese and fruit. Oh, let's make sure all goes well here in his reuniting with Bathsheba. And the story goes on, but Uriah is too faithful of a soldier. And perhaps if you've been in armed conflict with someone, you have a sense of duty and honor to them, and that's Uriah. He doesn't go home. He says, I can't go enjoy the comfort and joy of my home. So he just stays with the king's servants because he imagines himself, he's just another servant of the king. So he stays there. He's so faithful, and this just irks David to no end. His plan is not working. And so he brings him in the next night, and he tries to get him liquored up and send him back home. And Uriah gets liquored up, but he's still faithful, and he staggers to a couch somewhere in David's house and sleeps it off. And David is like, this isn't working! Why? Because Uriah is faithful. Uriah is being honorable and righteous, everything that David is not being now. And so the plan enlarges. He has to send Uriah back to the battle, but he has to do something with him because he knows the pregnancy is coming along. He's got to clear his tracks. He's got to cover this over so nobody will know. How many of you watch soap operas, by the way? There's a few, yeah. Probably a few more just won't raise their hands. It's okay. It's a form of storytelling and entertainment and such, yeah. This David's story sort of feels like some of the earliest of soap operas, doesn't it? I mean, it's just one turn after another of bad choices, and they the sin grows larger and larger, and it's informative for every one of us because, of course, that's what happens with sin. That's what happens when with our own fumbles, isn't it? We do one thing thinking it's just this. It's just so little, so measly. It's not going to be a big deal, and then it gets bigger and expands and expands. When I was about 8 years old, I don't know why I did it. My parents had a cedar chest, you know, Hope chest. You remember those, right? Anybody, you got one of those somewhere? Yeah. And I'm remembering back and trying to just, what was I thinking? I have no idea. I decided to carve my name in the top of the cedar chest one day. I think I did it with a butter knife, right? I mean, this was high quality craftsmanship right here. I have no idea why. I cannot remember. Maybe I was mad at mom or dad. Maybe they told me to clean my room or something. I don't know. But I knew every moment I etched into the top of that cedar chest, this was wrong. This was bad. But I did it anyways. And then, of course, what did I have to do? Well, the minute I got done and knew how awful it was, how wrong I had been, I was like, oh, I had to cover it up, right? So I made sure to find some of mom's clothes and stack them on top of the cedar chest conveniently over the corner where I had carved my name. And of course, then having covered over the sin, I escaped. I went out to play and played down the street and tried to stay out as long as I could. But of course, there came the telltale call at some point. Eric Allen! Yeah, Allen's my middle name. You all know what happens when middle names come out. Yeah. It's the thing about sin. It seems so simple sometimes. Sometimes it doesn't make sense, and it almost always blows up and expands and grows larger and larger and larger. And boy, if that's not true for David. He sends Uriah back to the war front with his own death sentence. He has a note for Joab, the commander, that says, look, when Uriah gets there, put him in the midst of the fiercest part of the battle and withdraw so that he is killed. Joab takes heed, he sends him into battle, Uriah dies. And he sends word back to David. David gets word. Our text picks up and says, when the wife of Uriah heard that her husband was dead, she made lamentation for him. And when the mourning was over, her mourning period, David sent and brought her to his house, and she became his wife and bore him a son. But then there's this line. But the thing that David had done displeased the Lord. Now, if you had all of 2 Samuel chapter 11 here, you would see God is nowhere to be mentioned throughout this whole sordid affair. And that's kind of the way things go on in sin, isn't it? It's like the minute we start to step into the things we know we shouldn't be, we sort of put God back there. We try to ignore God's presence. We sort of hope God's not paying attention, right? That seems to be the way for David. David, who for chapter before, God was at the center. He had this God-saturated mindset. But when we step into sin, it puts this fog into our brain sometimes, doesn't it? It sort of puts God at a distance. And so God's nowhere to be found in the story until this last line of chapter 11. The thing David had done displeased the Lord. Ominous words, aren't they? But this is what happens next. The Lord sent Nathan to David. Nathan was a prophet, and he'd been around in David's court for a while. He was trusted. He understood him as a loyal, faithful man of God. And I have to wonder how Nathan feels about this, having been sent to the king by God. And he came to him. And he said, now, David, let me tell you a story.
There were two men in a certain city, the one rich and the other poor. The rich man had many flocks and herds. The poor man had nothing but one little ewe lamb, which he had bought. And he brought it up, and it grew up with him and with his children. And it used to eat of his meager fare and drink from his cup and lie in his bosom. It was like a daughter to him. And now there came a traveler to the rich man. And the rich man was loath to take one of his own flock or herd to prepare for the wayfarer who had come to him. But instead he took the poor man's lamb, and he prepared that for the guest who had come to him. And David's incensed by this. It tells his anger was greatly kindled against the man. He said to Nathan, "Oh, as the Lord lives, the man who has done this deserves to die. He shall restore the lamb fourfold because he did this thing, and he had no pity." Seems David is very clear-headed about wrongdoing by others, right? Someone else. And I mean, I have to come clean myself. I'm really quick to notice other people's wrongs, right? Other people's fumbles and foibles. I could see those and go, "Oh, wow, what are they thinking?" Right? We're pretty good at that. We're pretty good at assessing other people's situations and actions and words. Sometimes we're doing all that just to ignore our own issues, aren't we? And that's certainly David here. He's clueless that Nathan is bringing him self-incrimination. Until finally, Nathan has to answer back to David's anger at this rich man's activity with the simple phrase, "You, David, you are that man." I sort of imagine him maybe a little more forceful than that. "You, David, it's you. You're the rich man who stole the ewe lamb. You're the one who took from someone else. You're the one who abused your power and authority. You, David." And I can read David's story and point to David and say, "Wow, how did he go so wrong?" But of course, Nathan's reproof comes and says, "Eric, you, you are the man, too. We are the ones, just like David, in whatever capacity, whatever way, shape, or form, sin creeps up. It's a part of our brokenness, and so we just have to be honest. It's not if we sin, but when. And what do we do about it? And how do we understand sin? For the longest time, sin to me was strictly an ethical term, a moral designation. It was about doing wrong, about some list. These are the things you don't do, and if you do one of those things, there's wrong. There's a check mark on God's list. Uh-oh, did that wrong. It was just this ethic issue. But sin is more than that. It does certainly have to do with ethics and morals, but it's deeper than that. It's a relational term. It has to do with our relating to our neighbor and to God. It's what gets in the way of the relationship. Eugene Peterson put it this way. He said, "Look, the basic fundamental condition of our humanity is God. We're created by God. We're redeemed by God. We're blessed by God. We're provided for by God. We're loved by God. That's our basic condition. Sin is the denial or ignorance or avoidance of that basic condition. Sin is the word we use to designate the pervasiveness of will by which we attempt being our own gods or making for ourselves other gods. And ultimately, sin diminishes who we are and who others are. Ultimately, sin is not just, oh, you did bad, you did wrong, I made a bad choice there, I fumbled mightily. Sin is a relational descriptor. When I sin, it creates a barrier between me and you, a barrier between me and God. It's more than just an ethic. It's a way to describe our condition. We're with God, and then sin puts up these walls. So what do we do about it? Well, then David is confronted, and Nathan says, "You are the man, David." The light bulb finally goes on. And he has a moment of clarity and says, "I have sinned against the Lord." He has a confession. And when I understood sin just merely as the ethic, the right or wrong, I was confused by this confession. "I've sinned against the Lord?" No. You sinned against Bathsheba and Uriah and other men in the army who died because of your choices. And if it were only an ethic, a choice, a list of do's and don'ts, then "I have sinned against the Lord" wouldn't make sense. But if it's a relational comment, connection, then it starts to make sense. Ah, he has sinned against Uriah and Bathsheba and so many others. There's brokenness between he and they, but he's also disconnected from God now. That's what sin does. But in his confession, in his recognition of his fumble, big as it is, costly as it is, God redeems. We, in our prayer of confession earlier, used a version of Psalm 51. That's the psalm David penned after this moment with Nathan the prophet, when he came to his senses and he said, "Oh, who am I?" Oh, here are some of another way he has been translated. "O generous and love God, give grace. Huge in mercy, wipe out my bad record. Scrub away my guilt. Soak out my sins in your laundry. I know how bad I've been. My sins are staring me down. You're the one I violated. You've seen it all, seen the full extent of my evil. You have all the facts before you. Whatever you decide about me is fair. I've been out of step with you for a long time, in the wrong since before I was born. What you're after, God, is truth from the inside out. And so enter me then and conceive anew true life." This is David's confession. And God honors it. God says, "You will not die because of this." There isn't immediate sort of judgment here. God says, but there are consequences, and that's always true of sin. There's consequences, and so there will be strife in David's life. The child Bathsheba bears will die. There'll be family strife from now on in David's household. There's consequences all along, but I think the confession, the honesty, the openness by David in the midst of his humongous fumble is what restores the relationship. By that humility, that openness, that brokenness, God says, "Oh, I'm so glad you noticed. Now let me love you. Let me redeem you. Let me forgive." We've been using stones throughout our series. The five smooth stones David picked up at the brook before his battle. And we've had some stones to remember. How do we face our giants? Well, today our giant, of course, is ourselves. But we have to remember, what are the stones? Well, the first one was the stone of what? The past. If you advance one, you'll see it come up. Yeah. Stone of the past, remembering God's faithfulness before us. And then there was the stone of what? Remember the second one? Prayer, right? Yeah. David David cried out to God in the wilderness, Lord, help. Last week we talked about the way in which David could see Saul as more than Saul. And so it was a stone of what? Perceptions. Good. Notice they all start with the letter P. There you go. Good. So what today might our stone be? Starts with the letter P. Very close. Not penance. Catholic theological term. We're gonna not go that one. As good as it is. But close. Penitence. Give it to me. You're a winner! Penitence. How is it David gets described as a man after God's own heart? Even in the midst of all the sin, I mean, huge, painful, destructive life choices he goes about. I think a part of it is there is this humility and openness and brokenness that David admits before God. There is penitence in his life. And he says, have mercy on me, O God. If we can't get to there, if there is no penitence in our life, then the barriers remain. Then we just hold on to our brokenness, onto the sin, the fumble, the struggle, and the walls are there. It's only when we're honest and truthful and say, Lord, wow, I really muffed this one. Yeah. Lord, can you forgive? And God says, yes. Lord, can you redeem? And God says, yes. Lord, could you love a wretched sinner as I? And God says, yes. That's who I am. So this week, as you find your stone in your pocket or your purse or on your nightstand, wherever you see it, may it make us mindful of our own fumbles and perhaps call us to penitence this week so that we can not wallow in guilt or anxiety or fear, but be freed of it, be renewed by God's forgiveness and mercy. It's wide open and big. It's why the table is set today, because that's the nature of God. So may we be people of penitence this week. Well, Lord, every one of us, if we're honest, could pray the prayer of David from Psalm 51. We might use other words, Lord. We might have other ways to share it, but it is true of us too, O Lord. We have fumbled plenty. And yet you still our Abba, Father. You are still the God of grace and mercy, still the God who loves and redeems and forgives. So, Lord, may we come to you humbly this week, seeking, finding, and discovering your grace and your love. We ask in Jesus' name. Amen.